Session number 9796, William Spearman, Reel 2.
And I must say that during my time with the commandos, being given these compasses, these sea compasses in our clothes and certain types of money, that I always felt that I wouldn't mind if I got left behind on a raid. Because I thought on this occasion there was a possibility of being left behind, having seen the sea battle. And we had, if we were left behind, we were given certain indications of where we would find assistance. Anyhow, to get back to the story, this ferry light went off and we, recalling us to the beach, and I can't remember going back to the beach, quite honestly, but eventually I found myself on one of these motor torpedo boats. Now, normally when you get on a motor torpedo boat after a raid, get onto the mothership, as it were, I mean, off the landing craft. It's only the landing craft that can go into the beach and pick you up, and then they go out a little way, and then you get onto the parent ship, or in this case, motor torpedo boats. And when we got onto it, we were all ushered with great speed down into the wardrobe area underneath the ship. Normally, we'd hang about up the top or anywhere with peace and calm, you know, and relieved to get away safely from the raid, as it were. But with this time, with this shooting still going on, we were all ushered down with all speed into this wardroom part of the ship underneath the deck. And then it was up to the Navy to get us back. And we mooched around this wardrobe, and I saw that the radio office, there were two men in the radio office, and it was full of signal equipment. And I suppose this was the heart of the ship's communication centre. So we then just settled down in this wardrobe, and this radio thing was adjoining in the wardrobe, as it were, and suddenly a shell came through, right through the side of the ship, and exploded in this communication, but of course killed the two people inside. And this was the most frightening experience, having got on a ship from a raid thinking you were safe, and the battle was still going on after you'd left the landing craft and gone onto the motor torpedo boat, which indicated they must have had a hell of a time, because they must have been doing battle ever since they dropped us off a few hours earlier. And this was to be in a room with this terrific explosion on a ship really made me delighted that I wasn't a bloody sailor or in the Navy. And I remember saying I'm damn glad that I left the Merchant Navy when the war started, because that was the most terrifying experience. I think it would be to anybody, especially to somebody who wasn't normally a seaborne soldier, as it were. Anyway, that happened then, and gradually the shooting stopped, and we eventually got back again. And the paper was full of it. Canadians land in France, land in Boulogne. And you know, they apparently, if you read Lovett's book, the one reference he makes to the Boulogne raid, they got actually stranded on a sandbank and never landed at all.
How did the men in Four Commando react to the publicity?
Well, I'm sure they reacted like me. First of all, we heard when we got back that the Canadians refused to land. That's what we heard. But when I read Lovett's book, where it said they were stranded on a sandbank, we obviously got the wrong story. Because I found, in retrospect, looking back, the officers in the unit, like Lord Lovett and Porteous and whoever the officers were, got together and got briefed at one level, and they were always completely in the know. But when you're not a commissioned officer, when you're just an ordinary rank or an NCO, you get a different degree of debriefing or briefing, and you're not in the same picture at all. I'm not saying you have to be, because you have your job to go to do on a raid, and you don't have to know too much else. And as I said before, that when the war was over and I started reading the books that came out, I learnt more about the commandos and the various raids than what I ever knew when I was in them. And this is an instance. We heard on this Boulogne raid, we heard the Canadians refused to land, and we were, you say, how did we feel, or how did the commandos feel about this headline, Canadian land in France? Well, we were livid, really, because we were under the impression they'd refused to land, the fire was so heavy. That's what we'd heard. Our fire wasn't heavy, they let us get ashore, you know what I mean? So I don't know how I came to think that. But Lovett's book really confirms to me, in any case, they never landed, they got stuck on the sandbank.
What was morale like after this Boulogne raid?
Oh, high, because, I mean, our whole life was geared up and to get off a boat under fire on a beach and do a raid. And if you survive it, you're on a high.
But the objective...
Even though we achieved... The objective, I don't think we ever put the radar station out of action. It wasn't my job to do that, so I can't say. I can't see us having gone all that way and not put the damn thing out of action, but... According to Lovett, it wasn't a very successful raid. It was a small raid only.
What was your own personal role to have been in the raid?
Well, we were made up in little penny packets. I think I was a corporal at the time. We were made up in penny packets. And I can't tell you, actually, what my particular role was. I've been thinking about this, even on the Dieppe raid. I can't think what my personal role was. Our personal role was always to survive and do what you had to do. We always had an objective to do. I can't think what my objective was. You're asking me, was my objective to go in and help destroy this battery in a group or what? I suppose it was radar. I suppose it was, but I can't remember. I can't remember my actual briefing like in that way. And according to Lovett, the raid was a small raid, which no doubt is true. My one... memory of that little Boulogne raid, but of course you must remember that on a small raid there's only 90 men going in on a raid. There's nothing behind you. If anything goes wrong, you've had your chips. When you go on a big thing like the Second Front, no matter what happens to you, the whole British Army is coming behind you. You know, so a small raid is much nicer, much more invigorating, as it were. You know what I mean? Because you're actually on your own.
You said
one thing I remember from it, which is another thing that Lovett actually confirmed in the thing, because I've read it, that we got one officer, before the Boulogne raid, we had one officer posted to it. I can't even remember his name now, but I think he was from the police force. He was a lieutenant, and he came, something to do with the police. Very likeable chap, you'd think going to be a marvellous chap when we got into action, this sort of thing, and he probably was, but... When the newspaper were full of Canadians landing in France, of course, our story was there as well. And the news people obviously got hold of, they always go for the officers. And Lovett was very strict on very little communication with the press. And if you had communication, not us, but among the officers, because we wouldn't meet the press anyway. But this young lieutenant who'd recently joined No. 4 Commando, when he left the boat, he either lost his shoes or something, and he had to leave the boat with carpet slippers on. And the one big thing that came out of the Boulogne raid was News of the World headline, one of the headlines among the other, Commando lands in carpet slippers. That's one thing everybody will remember, and I remember it so well. And it shows you how the Express and the tabloid Express where it would have been. How they just pick up something and make a bloody story of it. I mean, it's a disgrace to think there's somebody landing carpets, because if he had any long walks to do or anything serious to do, barbed wire, I mean, what the hell would a pair have been bloody slippers? But it's glorified as a feat, you know. Why not do the raid in comfort and this sort of thing? Of course, Lovett fired him straight away when it happened. I mean, I didn't know that, but I read it in his book. The bloke just disappeared, you know. I mean, the press... Well, we all know what the press do, you know, especially in the tabloid press. Anyway, that was the Boulogne raid.
Did you then immediately start preparing for Dieppe?
Well, it happened in the same year, I think 3 months later, May, June, July, August. It was 3 or 4 months later. We were always training for raids. The time when we started raiding, training specifically for Dieppe, yes, it must have began shortly after that. And there was all the controversy in the British Army and the War Office where we were going to pick for a landing. I mean, we tried Boulogne. I mean, we found out all sorts of things about it, you know, about the shingle and the beach and the air and this sort of thing. But the requirements for a second front, of course, needed more than what you'd want on a small raid. So there was always this question of where should we land, and Lovett, or maybe... somebody higher up than Lovett in the commandos, were very keen that we should land where they least expected us, like a rocky coast. Because we did dozens of courses, parachute courses, mountaineering. We went with Lord Hunt in Scotland. We went with other people, Dawson, the Colonel Dawson, I think, and other people in Wales, myself, going rock climbing there. So we were all climbers. And half of our training was assaulting either chalk pits out in the country or assaulting on rough coasts, as well as non-rough coasts. But we, in a way, we'd become sort of specialised in attacking a rough coast. And somebody in, to do with the commander, I know Lovett, was anxious, thought it was a good idea to make a landing on a rough coast, I mean, Brest or somewhere like that, you know. But, and I remember during our training, in order to make our point that a landing could be made, of course not by the main army, but an assault could be made on a rough coast from which we would be unexpected. They wouldn't be expecting us from a place like that, and it would give us a hell of an initiative, and we could then do all sorts of things.
By a rough coast, you mean a rocky coast?
Rocky coast. So, the powers to be must have said, I mean, I don't know what went happen, I was only just an ordinary guardsman or something called. Whatever happened, they decided, right, if you say you can land on a rocky coast like Brest, pick your spot and give us a demonstration. So Lovett then picked the roughest bit of coast he could think of, which is a knife, it was a Corbel. And he said, and of course they arranged this demonstration of a rough land, of a landing by command. It was on the roughest coast we could find, which is St Ives, where the, on a certain type of day, and certainly on the day we did it, the tide fall was 10 or 12, 14 feet. You know, the water comes in like that, you're getting off a boat, and it comes up for a minute with all white foam splashing, and then it drops 12 feet, you know what I mean?
Are there great cliffs there?
Oh, yes. I think it was St Ives, I'm quite sure it was St Ives. Oh, it was St Ives, it was renowned for its cliffs, terrific cliffs. I've never been back since there, but we were on a mothership anyway, out at sea, and we didn't have a salt landing craft at that time. We were doing this demonstration in sort of flat-bottom barges. And some way or another, we were pushed off from the open mouth of this ferry-type barge. And if I remember right, there were the demonstration was three boatloads of us, I suppose 30 men to a boat. And all these generals and Americans and whoever it was were all gathered up on the top of the cliff, you know what I mean? And the one thing we didn't know is that the whole thing was being filmed at the time. And that's actually, it's in the archives now. You should look it up. It's called Rough Landing, I think. I've seen it twice by accident, but I know it. I know this film exists now, and something under the name of Rough Landing or something. Can't remember now, but it's definitely in being. You should look it up. You'd be surprised. Anyway, these three boats came in, and just talking about my own personal boat, there's a fellow called Fogey Watkins. We used to call him Fogey. A fellow called Watkins in charge of our boat. And you can imagine the boat comes in and the water, the noise, of course, of the suction of the sea is overpowering. There's white spray going everywhere. And the water comes up and the boat rises up, rears up like a stallion. And so for a momentary, as the water drops, then it's left in the air and then it crashes down. If it were to tip the rock, it would tip the whole bloody lot over. And what the object was, that two men, every time it came up, was to leap onto the bloody rock, you know, which we did, in fact. I mean, the idea that somebody suggested the bow rope of the boat, once the first one to get ashore to hold onto the bow rope just to keep it there, because the drop of the tide was longer than the bloody bow rope, you know. And to cut the story short, I mean, I got ashore and all the fellows in our boat, I think they all got ashore, but one of the boats overturned and actually... two men, I thought more, but apparently it was two men who drowned. So this film shows you these two men who were drowned. You know, the boat turned over and quite a few heroics went on there rescuing these people from this terribly frightening water situation, you know.
Tell me more about it, if you can.
Well, I can't tell you any more. I don't know whether you know anything about the sea in a rocky area, you know. I mean, the sea is all very nice when you're on a boat or on a river or something, but if you're in a sea which is not a quiet sea, which is just even a little bit rough, take it as a middle rough sea. then is it the North Atlantic that comes up at St. Ives? It's very near the North Atlantic, a hell of a power, nothing will stop the sea. And so it comes crashing against whatever's there, in this case cliffs, it comes crashing against the cliffs. And if you're in that situation near or even above it, the noise is so frightening, you step away from the edge because it seems to have a sucking, a hell of a pulling power, a power to you, you know, a very frightening situation. And when you're actually down at water level with the intention of getting ashore, when, as I say, this boat rises up at least 14 feet and rears up like a stallion, hangs momentarily in the air, and then the water drops, and you drop and you thump down when you catch up with it again, you know. And if you were to hit a rock, as I say, meanwhile, anything could happen. Most frightening situation. But we took it, we were frightened or anything like that. We'd done it lots of time before, but not quite so bad as this, or not quite in the same sort of boat. These are sort of flat barges as opposed to steel landing crafts, you know. But anyhow, it was a most frightening situation. But anyway, when these fellows got drowned, it was a bit of a catastrophe. Whoever was left in the boat went back to the mothership, and to cut it short, we all returned to where we were, I can't think where the hell we were. And then the next morning, or that night, they gave us they were going to do it again. It was the meeting was rearranged, all the generals and that were going to come back again. They got cancelled because of this bit of catastrophe. Which is sad, really, that it should happen like that. And then they asked if you didn't want to go again, to step back. So everybody decided we'd go again, but this time they nominated some people to be on the cliffs already with life-saving ropes, so that if anything happened, they could go in tied to a rope with life belts and as a rescue service.
Can I just...
Yes, I was nominated as one of these lifesavers on this occasion. I can't remember why I was nominated as a lifesaver. I think they asked for volunteers from good swimmers for a dangerous mission. And I don't know why I volunteered again, because I wasn't all that wonderful a swimmer, but in any case, I was nominated as one of the lifesavers to be on the cliffs when the boat landed, which is what happened. I attached to this long rope, and I had ropes and life belts to try to save people if anything went wrong, but on this occasion, the weather wasn't quite so rough, and the whole landing took place in a perfect manner. You know, it was a very, very good demonstration. And then, of course, we demonstrated without any trouble how to get up these very high cliffs, carrying our equipment, which we were quite expert at this sort of thing, you know, having gone over some of the cliffs in North Wales, smooth cliffs without any handhold, going up these ragged St. Ives cliffs was, in a way, a piece of cake to us. And we got to the top, and the whole demonstration went off satisfactorily. So, as I say, this is one of the trainings which was not necessarily meant for Dieppe, but it was certainly meant for how an invasion or how an assault in France could take place. And I think behind it was Dieppe, which was going to be done as a large-scale landing, as a pre-runner to the eventual invasion, as it were, as you know. So there we are, that was part of our training. So yes, shortly after Boulogne, nobody, love it or nobody, none of the powers-to-be knew what our next job was going to be. I'm sure before Dieppe come in, we were probably assigned or told to get ready or stand by for certain operations which never transpired. I can remember one occasion like this. I can't remember its exact date, but I think it must have been after the Boulogne raid and before the Dieppe raid. I think it was my troop, which was either B troop or C troop. I did a parachute course with 30 other people, and we became C troop. So I can't remember whether it was us who went to Scotland for this particular operation, but I'll tell you about the operation roughly. A bunch of us, I suppose one troop, were sent to Scotland with a bunch of mules. We were in very hilly, bloody country, and I can't tell you where it was. We went to so many places in Scotland, I can't tell you where this was. I've no idea. Lord Lovett, no doubt, would know. All I can recall from it, we were dumped with tents and these mules up in the Cuds or up in Scotland, in very hilly country, and we were told to familiarise ourselves with these mules, look after them, and I can't tell you what we were told. All I remember was being given these mules, and all of us, none of us, maybe the commissioned officer, but none of other ranks like me had ever had any contact with a bloody horse, let alone a mule. So we immediately thought then, Christ, you know, we must be going to the Far East or Burma or somewhere like this, you know, what the hell is happening? Anyway, it was the same to us wherever you went to war. We were all young fellows together, and we really enjoyed this time with his mules. The weather wasn't kind. It was bad weather, I remember very well, but we enjoyed the situation. And when we rejoined our units, we were immediately told we were going to do a raid in Holland or somewhere. And we thought, well, isn't it typical? We spend all that time and money and that lovely time in Scotland with all these mules and in rough country. We come back and then we're sent to a flat bloody country like Holland to do a job. But typical of the mess up and the uncertainty. And of course, looking back now, having read the books and learnt more about the overall plans and things, of course, the War Office had to be. They had to be shown that the commander type of operation, which Churchill, of course, liked, because he was involved with it in other theatres of war, it had to be proven to them that the whole thing was worthwhile, you know. And I think at that time maybe they had ideas of sending it out to Burma or somewhere. I can't remember the exact time when it was, but anyhow. And the whole thing then, all the commander training, we were always training for one raid or for another raid. And in the event, this raid on Holland, which I say we were told we're going on, never actually transpired. So I can't tell you where it was, except that we heard that it was Holland. And then eventually, with a lot of string pulling, I think, from Lovett and other people, yes, then we got assigned to the Dieppe raid. There were other raids taking place at the time, around about that time, St. Nazaire raid, which was almost a suicide raid on the U-boat dens by other commandos. There were raids going on, but number four commander, anyhow, got, at some time during that time, got assigned to the Dieppe raid. And as I've said before, the way you prepare yourself for a particular raid, you're shown photographs of an area. It could be in Scotland, it could be in Burma, you don't know where the hell it is. It would be the Dieppe area in this case, and we were shown photographs of the type of areas, and we were familiarised. A plan was worked out of what we were to do and what our job was to do, and we got tuned to a T. I mean, Bangalore, it was known from aerial photographs that on the beach there was this Dannet wiring guarding, and there were pillboxes and things like that, even where we were going to land. And so we knew we had to get over this Dannet wiring, for instance, and this idea of Bangalore torpedoes, I know, was introduced at the time. I think prior to that, I hadn't really heard of these Bangalore torpedoes, which roughly is only a tube of a metal tube which is bung full of explosives. You stick a fuse on the end of it, light it, and the whole thing blows up, and the concentrated blast blows a gap in the wiring. This was the idea of it. So we practiced using Bangalore torpedoes all over the place, and we just carried on generally with all the things we do. And then, of course, our objective at the number four commander's objective was to destroy the guns. There were two gun batteries guarding the Dieppe Bay, or guarding Dieppe, and one commander was assigned to the other gun battery, and number four commander was assigned to this gun battery. I can't remember whether we had photographs of this battery. I think we did have aerial photographs of it. I can't really remember. But anyway, it was a square sort of thing with the guns inside, you know, defended by pits and turrets going up into the sky, and the usual sort of defence pylon type of thing with machine gun at the top, so you couldn't approach it very easily. So we practised how we were going to do all this sort of thing, down to the finest detail. Everything was done troop by troop. There were three troops, I think, involved on the Dieppe raid. One was to do a sweep around the right-hand side, which was my troop, to assault from that side. F troop with Colonel Porcherson, I think, his job was to assault from the other side. And of course there had to be some clarification because you were facing each other. And then there was a beach defending party who had to prepare a beach for the getaway. I think that was roughly the idea of our part of the Dieppe raid.
So, were you on attacking the gun battery to the east or to the west of Dieppe?
Right on the right-hand side, if you look at France, so that would be the one to the west, wouldn't it?
Yes.
Varangville. If I just say now, just to clarify it, number 6 commander did the other gun battery, and we did our gun battery. Now, we were extremely lucky. We crossed the channel without much interference. And as my particular ALC, landing craft, landed, the front door of the landing craft, as it beached, was dropped down. And machine gun fire came right into the boat. But until that moment, we'd had no trouble at sea. And we had, I think, 2 or 3 other landing craft dropping F troop and the other troop there in a similar area fairly nearby. We couldn't see them. But the number 6 commando, who attacked the other gun battery, they were unfortunate enough to run into a convoy of E-boats. And I've told you about E-boats. They're like our mortar torpedo boats, but they're faster. Because they were sitting in AOCs, they hadn't hope in hell of surviving. And they actually got blown out of the water. It's well documented now what happened to them. Half a dozen men only got ashore, and Colonel Brigadier Young, he got ashore. And they actually reached the within shooting distance of the battery, even though there were only a handful of people, you know. So they were most unfortunate there, because they met this convoy of E-boats at sea, and there was nothing they could do, very little they could do. But with us, we were lucky. We actually got ashore, and we run right into trouble. We had machine gun fire come into the thing, and Captain Webb, this young lieutenant, who is now a captain, he was in charge of a sea troop, in whose boat I was in. He got wounded. It didn't stop him. He had his arm in a sling. He put one arm out of action. And we all disembarked over the side of the boat. It wasn't panic stations, but it was pre-prepared tactics, you know. Get out of the boat, don't all file up to go out the front entrance, because you wouldn't, would you? So we got out of the boat anyway and got ashore. And it was a very much shelving beach. And because machine gun fire was coming over this Dannet wiring, and on the right-hand side, there was machine gun fire coming along the beach, but it was coming from a long distance, and there was tracer fire in it, otherwise you wouldn't have known where it was coming from. Somebody miles away up there were firing along the beach to it, but it was ineffective, probably out of distance, but you could see these ricochets coming. So machine gun fire coming over the Dannet wiring, not permanently, just in spasms. I suppose when they got a silhouette or something, you know, the Germans got a silhouette. That your one inclination was to dig into the shingle and make a hole for yourself, but wrong thing to do. When the second front actually happened later on, you could see it. The people who went in before us dug a hole and they never moved off the beach and got slaughtered and drowned in their own blood almost. So it's the wrong thing to do that, because it wasn't my job to blow the Mangalore torpedo. Somebody had a job to blow the Mangalore, and we had to wait there while they were done. And I thought, until I went back to Dieppe last year, I thought then the Bangalore torpedo went up and we made a dash through the thing and went off. And somebody put a grenade in the slit concrete post and put the Germans out of action. Then we made our way on to our assignment. But I heard this year, when I went back to the reunion at Dieppe after 44 years, in fact, there's Gordon Webb, the chap who got wounded and who was my captain. He was the only other one from C Troop who was there. I wanted to talk to him. But unfortunately, because he'd been on the bottle, as it were, he wasn't ever in a fit state really to talk very much. But one of the things he did say to me was that the Bangalore torpedoes never went off. Something went wrong with them. I never knew that. I don't remember that.